all, and welcome back to Cracked with Siobhan Aris. Thank you to this episode's sponsor, Canfield Technologies, whose diverse line of products allow you to find a stained glass and jewelry solder to meet your needs. Find out more at canfieldmetals.com. Today's guest is Los Angeles artist Timo Fehler. Timo uses plaster, ceramics, steel, wood, and found objects to construct highly visual and culturally significant works. Combining formal elements of sculpture with references to his heritage, Fehler's work explores ideas of use and reuse through casting and manipulating found objects and combining them with relics that relate to personal experiences. His restructuring of objects in a manner that indicates function and meaning while remaining abstract in form invokes a bricolorian practice, representative of a multicultural aesthetic. All right, let's get into it with Timo. Join me as I crack it all wide open.
Hi, Siobhan.
Hi. Can you hear me? Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. I've got you on my headphones. I'm in a kind of a communal studio building. So occasionally there's a loud noise here or there, but I'm usually the one doing that. So
I think you're good. It sounds really good. You may hear some sound on my end too. My daughter is home from school today. She has strep throat. So I gave her, I shoved a Pedialyte freezer pop in her mouth and said, please, please, please just stay out there and watch SpongeBob with headphones on for like 2 hours, please.
That sounds almost dreamy. We have a new infant and learning about the kind of idiosyncrasies of how you deal with different scenarios. In one particular case, like sickness is definitely it's just a new thing. My partner has always been super caring and nurturing. And when I get sick, I'm pretty miserable. and so it was funny to kind of have that, like, you know, this, the infant being a little part of you and seeing him sick and seeing like the misery that he's in and recognizing like, oh my God, I've just been such a, like a weak baby compared to, compared to this like actual baby, to an actual weak baby. So it is, it's interesting.
Yeah. It's a trip. Every part of it, having becoming a parent, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is this your first child?
Yeah.
Okay. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. He is 10 months now and or I guess coming up on 11 months. Yeah. They are currently in Europe. She's an art writer and I'm an artist, and we both have kind of maintained a very flexible schedule with our work and traveling a lot. And, so either one of us is gone for 3 to 4 months out of the year in different chunks of time and in different locations. And when we talked about, having a kid, we, also, kind of discussed, you know, what that would look like whenever it came to, projects and traveling and things like that. And, just kind of, you know, attempted to and are still attempting to remain flexible with that. So currently they just left a week and a half ago for Copenhagen, and then they're back in Amsterdam. They'll be going to Sweden in a couple weeks. These are all for like writing jobs that she has. She's been breastfeeding, so he can't really be separated from her
for
that long. But it's amazing. He's, like I said, 11 months old. He's already been to more countries than I had in my first 30 years of life.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah.
To be able to give him a life like that, you know, I mean, even though it's his first year and he may never remember it, and, you know, who knows, maybe we settle down and never travel to another country again. It's still an amazing, like, just a thing to be able to kind of say that I've tried to give to him, that we've accomplished as you know, a partnered couple. I don't know. Have we started?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think this is all really, you know, really interesting. I also want to say that he may not remember this, but you're doing a really good job of conditioning him to be a good traveler, which I think is a really, ACEs trait for a child to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a good number of planes, and only kind of one meltdown that was just like, it's, you know, you gain a whole new level of like sympathy and empathy with other parents and screaming children on planes where you're just like, well, we're going to go through this, you know, because there's no options. And, and it's just like, it's a little edgy and a little uncomfortable, and you just want, you know, this child to be okay. And then you're starting to recognize like these, like, I don't know if it's like fear, if it's shame, if it's anxiety that comes up because, you know, your baby is just like screaming his head off and can't stop. And there's nothing we can do to stop it. And so it's just like, okay, well, this is all part of learning. And so there was one episode where, you know, we had to like wait in a line for a while. Then they were like refueling on the tarmac for a while. And everyone on the plane had been waiting for hours already. And then we're sitting in this, you know, unmoving hot thing that smells of gasoline, and everyone's just quiet and like ready to go. And he is just like top of his lungs, like exploding, you know. And I can just remember, like, I'm looking around and like we're trading him back and forth, and she's trying to feed him and he doesn't want anything. There's nothing to console him. And it's just, you know, it's just this like really memorable, solidifying moment of, oh, I'm a parent now. And like, this is what happens, you know? And as soon as the plane started moving, he like settled down and was quiet the rest of the flight. And he's been pretty simple, on most of the other flights. So
yeah, those experiences are so humbling. It's good. It's good to get checked every once in a while and be like, oh God.
Like statement that they talk about where like, oh, you learn so much more from your kids than you ever did growing up or whatever. I'm paraphrasing some quote out there that I shook my head at forever. And you know, I am learning a lot of things from, you know, and you know, partially it's not like he's teaching me things as much as it's like, oh, you're learning a whole new way of living, being a parent, caring for and nurturing for, you know, another individual. You know, I think the partner to partner relationship kind of expands and explodes and comes together and falls apart. And, you know, like it's like an accordion kind of thing that's just making a beautiful melody.
A big, beautiful, messy explosion of feelings and messiness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whenever somebody on the airplane is like giving me eyes or, you know, anytime that's happened, I'm just like, oh God, karma's coming for you. It is. And I'm just so sad that I'm not going to be there for it, because this moment right now is going to come, it's going to come back to you somehow, whether you're going to be a parent or you were a child at one point, you know?
Mm-hmm. Siobhan, I had that exact experience. I was on a plane. I was watching this guy across the aisle kind of squirm every now and then, and, you know, looked over a couple times, and I was ready. I was sitting there like kind of looking at him, like, I'm waiting for us to catch eyes, guy. Just say one thing. And we landed and got up. This is beautiful. Got up and started to put our stuff together, and he leaned over and he said, "Man, I'm so sorry you had to go through that. I said a little prayer for you. I said a little prayer for your child, to help ease his you know, whatever it was that he was going through." And I was just like, "Oh." Here I am, like, seeing this guy and thinking that he's going through all of this, like, shut this fucking kid up.
Yeah.
You know, and then he pulls me aside afterwards. He's like, "Man, you know, good job. I said a prayer. You know," and I'm just like, oh man, wow. It's so interesting how like perception and our kind of defensive nature sometimes can put me in a space of negativity before anything else.
Yeah. You know, you're like, I was saying a prayer for you when I was about to do. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. That is good. You know, this is a little early to be throwing questions at you from Instagram, but it's applicable to what we're talking about. But at Barry Bonds asked, what's the hardest thing for maintaining your own identity after having a child?
Oh, man. You know, my partner would be an even better person to ask this because I've sat back and watched what I feel like is the kind of evolution of a human being in front of me. Like the mother to child relationship is an inseparable bond that is like just the most beautiful and glorious thing, and is also you know, for me to sit back and watch has just been like, what's happening here? And you know, this is, she wouldn't mind me sharing this at all. We have for a long time been kind of like partners in various projects, whether it's been like writing, curating, creating, organizing, and here Kala comes into our life. And, you know, in her pregnancy, it's one thing to recognize like, oh, you know, there's a lot of biological changes going on, and some other types. But then when he was born, there's obviously the first few months of the kind of literal inseparable connection every 3 hours, let's say, mm-hmm. you know, between feeding and sleeping and screaming and pooping, you know. And then, you know, she made a concerted effort, an actual decision to, she sold her vehicle and said, I want to take the year off and spend it with him. I, you know, fully in support of that and loved it. And I started to notice that like I was beginning to, and I had to talk to my therapist about this, beginning to recognize that I was kind of, in a way, losing this creative partner, you know? And so I was like asking her questions about her writing, and she's an amazing and beautiful poet. But she also is an like arts and culture writer, and kind of like asked these little questions about it, and realizing that between like, you know, the feeding and the nurturing and the care for this child, like you know, she had her smaller projects that she was working on, but, you know, nothing to the capabilities that she was before time-wise, right? And the effort. And so, you know, watching that shift and change for me was a little bit like I was concerned about someone losing their identity as an artist. So in asking her these questions about, or rather between kind of mentioning concerns about her loss of identity as a writer and talking with my own therapist about it, I was actually dealing with my own kind of feelings of like kind of separation anxiety between this human being and then this like partner. So we've got multiple dynamics there. And then this kind of like studio practice, you know, is essentially, had only recently become a full-time thing where it was like, I have gotten to a point to where I'm living my dream, being able to work for myself, doing something that I love. You know, and so you're kind of like attempting to juggle what seems to be like these, you know, very kind of weighted objects whenever it comes to, you know, contentment in life and whatever that means versus yeah. like happiness and sadness. Like, let's just, you know, like, and we haven't even thrown in like financial concerns or where are we living or, you know, like all of those things. And so, you know, kind of learning what that flow was and figuring that out. You know, I feel like I answered Barry Bonds' question from the perspective of, I mean, a little bit from my experience and coupled with her experience. It's been difficult to be away from them. I had a hard time even leaving to go to studio. So there were times where I would try to work from home. The traveling aspect also adds a little bit of a kind of like juggling effort, because when we are traveling, I need to be in studio, I have a hard time like kind of like leaving them at home in order to go to work. There's like a necessity for it, right? There's like the kind of financial necessity, and then there are like physical deadlines that I have as far as things that need to get produced. You know, that said, it's always like I can just go have one meal with them real quick. Mm-hmm. You know, I could kind of like pop in or pop out, or I can just stay for a couple more hours. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's shifting and it's evolving. And that's something that I have noticed since the beginning, since he was born. There was some sort of, at least for me physically and psychologically, some sort of what felt like a biological, like maybe the clock or whatever, that just kind of moved into a different motion. I didn't need to sleep as much. I was able to wake up a little bit more and be of assistance whenever it was the middle of the night. You know, it was a really kind of strange thing that like felt as though I was kind of like being pulled into a new schedule.
Yeah.
And kind of a new understanding of what that was.
It's like the most important deadline of your life.
Yeah. Yeah, really is. And it's been great to be there for him and her, and to kind of do things differently. I think when I talk about that, you know, there's a lot of talk these days, especially about kind of correcting generational grievances, mm-hmm. traumatic experiences, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is. It seems as though everyone's got that problem with the way they were raised, including me. And you know, in a lot of ways, they tried their hardest, and in a lot of ways, they, and particularly my mother, were perfect, you know. And then there are some ways where, you know, it just like things could be done differently,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it's nice to kind of like step into that zone and recognize that, and do the work in order to get there and to be there.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And I think that when you are fully capable of that self audit and sort of like that reflection on how you are raised and how you want to be different than your parents, and you know, there's certain like pain points where you feel really, really strongly about, like, I'm never going to do it like that. I think sometimes the biggest challenge there is not letting the pendulum swing too far the other way, you know, on some things, and also not projecting your fears and your insecurities from your childhood onto them, like reacting to a similar situation for them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, it makes complete sense. You know, and I've been talking with my therapist and other kinds of like support groups about it. You know, for the longest time, and it's been a really beautiful experience to go from like this person full of fear of just like, I don't want to repeat the same mistakes my father did,
mm-hmm.
Into a just like, oh man, you know, let me just hold this thing. Yeah. You know, we're not even there. You know, my biggest fears are the ones where he's like, I hate you, Dad. Mm-hmm. You know, you fucking ruined my life.
Yeah.
You know, and what it is there's a specific experience that I had during that time in my life when I felt like I really needed something that I wasn't getting there. You know, my dad was a very kind of specific, he grew up in a different time, you know, and he was a provider, but he was not really, like emotional support wasn't mm-hmm. A part of that package, would say. And for like a young creative person growing up in the Midwest, you know, it I found it difficult to relate in a lot of places. And so, you know, the places that I did find and the friends that I did have that I could relate to, I think were, it was kind of like the little bit of like an outcast kind of kids that were like punk DIY culture in the late 90s in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, small group of kids that were, you know, very active in doing things differently and doing things themselves. And I really related to that. And I loved the kind of creative vibe behind it. I loved, you know, the active engagement, I think, that everyone was required to do. This was like on the cusp of the beginnings of the internet, like kind of pre-MySpace even, to where, I mean, you know, we had phones and we're calling each other about like punk bands that were coming through town. And needed a place to play or stay. And so like a lot of early creative projects were about making flyers and t-shirts for punk bands and you know, having shows at parks or in basements of different houses, you know, things like that. This is like my earliest form of engagement with a chosen family and a community. You know, I wouldn't have called it that back then. You know, back then we were just looking for an escape and a place to, you know, maybe drink and get high and have fun with each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, it evolved in both directions for me as far as, you know, as I got older, the issues that came with being around that environment, came full circle, and also the, encouragement and the, kind of creative elements that came from being and running in that circle also, you know, came to a whole new set of fruition.
I remember that feeling too of just being like, this is where it's at. This is where the love is. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's and then beautiful that, like, when I catch.
Yeah. Catch and that like loyalty that comes with it to that scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a beautiful thing. I think, you know, ultimately an ongoing thesis for me has been like this idea of belonging. You know, I can point it out in others, but the best way for me to look at it is in myself. All I've ever wanted to do was belong. I've got like a huge amount of imposter syndrome, you know, that I'm not afraid to talk about. Was I punk enough for them? Am I, conceptual enough for them? Am I brown enough for them? Am I white enough for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, and so if I'm always asking myself these questions and always wondering whether or not I belong, I'm kind of wasting a lot of time, and turmoil internally. And so I try to stay away from that conversation, not saying that it doesn't come up in different ways, but, whenever it comes to kind of community building and finding comfort with each other, you know, I don't know. I think that's a much better work to be a part of, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, rather than working to find out where I fit in or whether or not I fit in, working to just do and make and be a part of.
Right.
You know, has been much more fortuitous, I would say.
Well, I would say you're definitely formally educated enough for me. In your bio, it says he received his MFA from UCLA and his BFA from the Kansas City Arts Institute. Fowler has created, how do you say your name? Am I saying it right?
It's actually Fowler.
Fowler. Is it? And Fowler, how do you say
is
your
the pronunciation?
Fowler. Okay.
Timo.
Timo, yeah. Fowler. Okay.
Yeah.
Fowler has created exhibitions that travel and explore the narrative of creative communities on the periphery across the United States, led youth programs at the Ramon C. Cortin School of Visual and Performing Arts, and guest lectured at the Kansas City Art Institute, School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and PAOS, an international nonprofit art incubator in Guadalajara, Mexico. Good job. That's a lot.
Thank you. I hear that. And I think about like the way those bios are kind of curated to, you know, that right there says he's a professional.
He knows. Yeah. He took the class.
Yeah.
And he understands what the assignment is. Yeah.
Exactly. Meanwhile, internally, I'm just like, well, hey, wow. You know, I have to hear that to recognize the professionalism that is sitting in front of you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I can get a little bit not argumentative, but like, you know, the reality is I stayed that like punk from Tulsa. You know, I moved to San Diego as soon as I could, which I think was around 19 or 20. I had cousins there. I didn't start Kansas City until I was 28 years old, undergrad. You know, I actually was in San Francisco before that. I'm jumping around the timeline a little bit, but when I was about 25, 26, I met with a woman named Judy McIntosh in Tulsa, going back and forth is what's happening here. And she really encouraged me to go to school, and I worked with her and her high school students for a little bit. She kind of just asked me to come in, and I didn't even take high school art. There's a kind of a long story that gets me there, but what it is she kind of just opened me up to like techniques and processes and materials. Mm-hmm. So here I am, 25, 26 years old. You know, I'd run out of Tulsa at 19, and was living in San Diego with my cousins and practicing art. You know, back then I had the desire and I had the creative drive. I didn't have the discipline. I didn't have the knowledge of materials and techniques. And you know, I can remember being that kid that was you know, critical of art school, critical of art training, because in my head, if you wanted to be an artist, you had to go out there and live the life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you got to, you know, a 19, 20 year old, you know, spewing off these things and thinking that, you know, balancing a job as a cook. You know, my cousin was teaching me to blow glass. There were two cousins there, had a healthy drug habit. You know, was running in that was kind of the first artist space that I was running on my own with my cousin, but that we had started in San Diego. And, you know, doing a lot of kind of creative endeavors and trying to juggle all these things without any kind of formal education. I doubt any of the art that I made back then still exists today, or if it does, I'm completely unknown as to where it is. Actually, one of my cousins, I think he's got a couple of things, but let's just say it was kind of like crude and uninformed. And that's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing to go through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I did. It was a very kind of like untrained experience. And, and you know, not everyone has to go through that. I don't think. I would say 9 out of 10 of my friends have gone straight from high school into art education, and then, you know, gone on to what they are. And there's all kinds of different stories, and you know, this one's mine.
Yeah, there really is. When did stained glass come into the picture? Because you do use a lot of different materials, but where did you learn how to use stained glass?
YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. I watched a couple YouTube videos and found out some basics. I asked a guy named Ron who runs, actually, I think he just sold Stained Glass Pasadena.
That's where I took classes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Stained Glass Supply Store of Pasadena. Janelle Fu just bought it.
Oh, okay.
She took over. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with Janelle. I know Molly, who works there. Molly's Magic Glass is her Instagram. She's I don't know if she's still working there. I think she's moved on to work for another art profession, and she worked with me for a little bit. So I watched a bunch of YouTube videos and kind of, you know, saw what was being done. I had worked with slumping maybe 10 years ago, and then lamp working 20 years ago. And so I had a little bit of knowledge there, but it's also very different, the process. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I watched a few YouTube videos and then went and bought a bunch of supplies and asked Ron a bunch of questions. And he was very free with his information. And then I just went home and started, you know, kind of making ill-informed decisions as far as like figuring out, you know, I didn't have a grinder for 6 months. And so, you know, I didn't even know what grinding was. And I think I used a Dremel tool a little bit once I started to see, you know, kind of how it was being done. I really just kind of explored different ways of getting to the point. And by that, I mean, like, I do jump around with a lot of different mediums, and I consider glass a medium. I don't consider myself a glass artist. If anything, I consider myself a sculptor that is using glass in order to both inform the work and present the work that I want to. So in order to get to the point. Now, I will say maybe 6 months after I started working with the stained glass, I was in Amsterdam. My partner was pregnant, and I had some free time in the daytime, and I found some Tiffany stained glass masters. They had a 30 to 40 year career of working on and repairing both like lead cane large stained glass windows for churches, but also doing a lot of Tiffany repairs for old old lamp. I took like a three week course, case from Bizarre Glass in Amsterdam. Case and Inica de Bont are their names.
Okay.
Case is spelled K-E-E-S. It's just one of those weird Dutch pronunciation. They have a spot called Bizarre Glass in Amsterdam, and they've just kind of been at it for a very long time. I didn't really know any of the community at that point. And they were having a little workshop kind of deal, and worked with me privately for I think we did about a month. A few times a week I would go in there, and he was one of those guys that would show you once, and then he would go and sit on his computer. And you know, I had to like, it was one of those things where I had all of these ideas of how it was done. As, for example, even cutting glass, you know, at that point I'm just like, okay, let me dig it in there, push really hard, and you know, and then you know, and he would just like, no, it needs to sound like a light zipper, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of, you know, and then he would do it in front of me, and then he would go sit down and he would be listening and be like, no, you're pushing too hard, mm-hmm. you know? And that was really beautiful because it made everything so much, you're getting new information, and that information is like changing the way you're doing things, yeah, making things a lot easier.
Yeah. Eliminating some of that trial and error.
Yeah, for sure. And again, I mean, that easily relates to, you know, my experience 20 years ago, like I said, where I from 19 to 25 years old, I'm out here like making things on my own without any idea or knowledge of actual materials and techniques that you would learn in some sort of institution. Doing it yourself and then going and finding out like, oh, there's an easier way of doing that, you know, or there's a better way.
Yeah. It says here, his restructuring of objects in manner that indicates function and meaning while remaining abstract in form invokes a Bruckelarian practice representative of a multicultural aesthetic. So I looked up, I was like, I don't know what that means. So I looked up the definition of Bruckelarian. In French, it's literally translated to handyman. And I was like, okay, well, how did it get to what he meant, bricolage,
exactly,
can be seen as a three-dimensional counterpart to collage. In the art context, bricolages are pieces made by attaching together materials gathered from various sources. Three-dimensional pieces utilizing fragments of non-art materials are called assemblages. And then I was like, well, I'm still confused. So I started Googling more. And it said, Claude Levi Strauss originally coined the use of the terms bricolage and bricoleur. The bricoleur, who is the savage mind, works with his hands in devious ways. This is a quote, puts pre-existing things together in new ways and makes do with whatever is at hand. What Levi Strauss points out here is that signs already in existence are used for purposes that were originally not meant for.
Wow. I had no idea Levi Strauss was connected there. But I love that everything you just said before I get too far, I want to talk about the rebar within my work, because that's going to like directly tie into the bricolage practice. Was there a word savage in there somewhere?
Yes. Yeah. I'll read that again.
Redefinition of
The bricolage, who is the savage mind, works with his hands in devious ways, puts pre-existing things together in new ways, and makes do with whatever is at hand.
That's beautiful. Pre-existing things together in new ways. I've worked with rebar for a long time, and I'll take that back to some of my earliest memories. My father worked with his hands. By the time we had grown up and were teenagers, they had a printing business and then sold that. But he was the guy that would walk around and fix all the presses. And he essentially kind of tore down the house that they bought when he first moved back to Tulsa and rebuilt it into a new house. He was always tinkering and working on motorcycles and pouring driveways and driving tractors. And my uncle had a farm. We'd go out and help him, with everything. So he was kind of like the jack of all trades. I grew up in that environment. So I grew up seeing that. So I grew up doing these things because he was dragging us along. There were three boys and we were there to help, and seeing him do all of these things. And so a lot of, the tools and the materials that I continue to work with, I learned from watching him. One of my earliest memories is definitely of him pouring our driveway and lacing all the rebar together inside of the driveway. And that never occurred to me whenever I first started using rebar. It was more of a cheap way of getting the point across, getting to the point. I was using this steel in order to make drawings. Rebar is kind of the cheapest steel there is. If you dive into it a little bit deeper, it's kind of the structural integrity of every foundation, let's say up to code foundation in the United States. There's always kind of rebar that's a heavy part of that structure, a heavy part of the columns and bridges, a heavy part of any kind of concrete foundations in buildings. So, you've got a very large amount of architecture that has this internal vertebrae or structure made from this material. So I'm talking about it in a little bit of what I would consider more of a poetic way, because, let's get back to the function of it. Like, I'm trying to make a three-dimensional drawing, essentially. And so I'm using the tools at hand, rebar and these kind of like hand benders and then welding it together, all techniques that if I didn't learn directly from my dad, I learned from watching him or seeing what he was doing. And then again, like adding some sort of art school education in order to throw like a little bit more of a creative bent to it, I would say. But I had been making these for a long time, these structures, and casting different materials in them or adding anything from linen and I've worked with plaster for a long time and ceramic. My degrees are actually in ceramics. And it kind of integrating a whole bunch of different materials into these three-dimensional drawings. And at some point, I definitely wanted a little bit more of a translucency or transparency. Mm-hmm. And I had worked with resin before and didn't really like the toxicity of it. And, you know, I can remember the exact piece. There was a tetrahedron kind of work that I had made. It was kind of an effigy. No, it directly was an effigy for a friend of mine, that one of my oldest best friends from Tulsa, who like a lot of kids never got away from that life, and died a really stupid death as a result of drugs and alcohol. And I had made this piece and really wanted to have a little bit more translucency. I wanted to see into it. There was a light underneath it, and I felt this kind of like glow with the work, and I wanted a little bit more interaction, because it was a three-dimensional, a tetrahedron is a three-sided triangle that is, supposedly one of the strongest shapes. And I was talking with actually a friend of my partner's online, and she said, "Hey, have you ever thought about throwing glass into there?" Because I was talking about that translucency, and you know, it was just like, "Oh yeah, I don't want to use resin. Yeah. Let's try glass." You know, and so the first works I made were both plaster and glass, and I would say plaster was like 80%, glass being like 20%. I wasn't completely invested in glass, and it's an expensive material. And so, you know, I was just doing little bits and pieces here and there, and I just really fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And kind of ran from there. But this is, I'm getting away from the original context of talking about the rebar, because, the way I see the process now, and the way you just define the bricoleur, is exactly what I'm thinking about. You know, they've been making stained glass for well over 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. Lead came windows. There's a lot of people that are doing it in amazing ways. You know, I mean, just go through your podcast and you'll see tons of that. And you know, I appreciate that. I love a good craft, and I love a good skill, and I love creativity in different regards. I think for me, it's important to evolve the conversation. And so, you know, when it came to using glass within these drawings that were made of rebar and steel, and then looking at stained glass windows, these like really old ones, obviously all of them, but you know, seeing how it's been done forever, I was just recognizing that I'm replacing the lead cane and some of the like kind of steel reinforcements with this rebar, mm-hmm. this very utilitarian, very much a kind of construction-based material, mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, turning it into an ornamental structure that is and relates to labor, you know, and specifically the labor that I had experienced in my own life with my father. You know, that's kind of a relationship that was broken that in some ways I'm able to connect. It's funny, because as I'm telling this story, I'm thinking a lot about one of my best friends, Rafa, and he kind of has a very similar narrative about how he reconnected with his father through adobe. And I haven't really thought about that till now. You know, Rafa makes an amazing adobe work, wow, it's just hitting me. But like, this, in some ways, this is a way for me to reconnect with someone who's not even alive anymore.
Honestly, I've been thinking that the entire time that you've been speaking. I've been waiting for my wow. moment to like say it. You beat me to it, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna have to talk to my therapist about that next week. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. At Log Lada asked, why glass? Is the transparency part of the conceptual meaning / narratives in your work?
You know, we kind of just touched a little bit of the aspect of that first work, and really wanting to have some transparency and some translucency in that. And as I dove deeper and deeper into glass and studying where it came from, or at least the origins of stained glass, and really thinking about the church harnessing the power of stained glass. You know, I became kind of infatuated with that story. You know, if we can go back to the 13th century, you know, you're there's no electricity. There's darkness and light in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you think about the first few hundred years of stained glass, and you think about the church, like this gathering place where people would go to, you know, and you're living in a village where you've got dirt floors and no windows, and you go to, you know, you walk into this like building, and all of a sudden you're just like floored by the majesty of this insane architecture.
Yeah.
Not only that, but there's this like colored clear thing shooting like, you know, beautiful colors across the room.
Just Jesus rays and all over you.
Telling stories at the same time, right? Because they talked about like using it as a device in order to tell stories because people couldn't read back then too. Right? So, you know, if we're thinking about the like the history of stained glass and these the origins and where it comes from, you know, it definitely became a device and a tool for this like one of the most powerful structures in the world to maintain that power. You know, like if I am just like used to toiling fields and, you know, working on farms all day, and I go to this space, I'm just like, I don't know what this is, but I want it. I want to be a part of this. I want, you know what I mean? Like it's just that I can't even really kind of fathom what that experience must have been like back then. So thinking about all that, like the rich history of the Western European development of stained glass and you know, how it eventually came over here. And then thinking about the translucency and the transparency and what I wanted to achieve with the works that I'm making here. For me, there's no way of getting around the Western canon. What I mean by that is that this particular material has been used for centuries in one way or another, like we just talked about. What am I going to add to that? So I thought, well, you know what, I'd like to kind of like take it back and tell some other narratives and kind of like hijack the idea of martyrdom. Mm-hmm. They're talking about all of these saints and stories that they're trying to tell. Let me tell some stories for a people that I relate to, stories that I might want to tell.
I was looking at your most recent work, and you have two pieces that I really want to ask you about. The first one is, it says self-portrait as Michelangelo Saint Bartholomew. I always want to put an L on the end there. Steel, aluminum, stained glass, lead. It's 48 inches by 13 inches. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. I'm worried about the person who wants it hanging in their house, but it is absolutely wonderfully executed. I was looking at it and, you know, I started Googling. And The Last Judgment is a painting by Michelangelo that covers the walls behind the altar in the Sistine Chapel. The work depicts the second coming of Christ, and just below the figure of Christ, Saint Bartholomew holds a sheet of his own skin with his left hand, and in his right hand is a knife. This symbolizes the terrible fate of Bartholomew, who was flayed alive. The face on the skin is reputed to be a self-portrait of the artist. I want you to talk to me about this. How did you come to this image, and why were you so inspired to recreate it in glass?
You know, whenever I work on an exhibition, I think about the series, I would say. You know, I was making that work would have been kind of the fourth in this series of, I think, eight works that I did with Sebastian Gladstone Gallery here in Los Angeles. And I was thinking a lot about the alter ego. I was thinking a lot about birth, rebirth, and regeneration. You know, a lot had just gotten pregnant at that point. I was thinking a lot about the kind of like, when I say alter ego, the presentation that that I utilize whenever it comes to the code switching that exists in different groups that I might run with. Mm-hmm. You know, and the kind of necessity for that. And I would say sometimes it's an unfortunate necessity. And maybe we can get into that in a little bit, but that piece specifically, you know, there's another story where Michelangelo talks about being very upset with the church for a number of kind of things, but one was the nudity that they were that they didn't like on his ceiling, on their ceiling, on his painting, and doing a lot of censoring of his work. And so the holding of his skin, he actually made that a self-portrait, though he said it was Saint Bartholomew that was like his flayed skin there. And it was kind of a fuck you to the church for, like, you know, taking all of his effort and minimizing it to like, oh, there's a penis there and it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. This is a house of God, you know? And I just thought that was kind of like a beautiful fuck you moment in a way, in that the artist kind of just like takes their power back.
Yeah.
In some small moment. But even further, yes, you can go down the Saint Bartholomew side of things. This tragic story is that this martyr and man was literally flayed alive and shown his own skin suit. A story that you know exists in different cultures. Even in the Aztec culture, there's a stories of people being flayed and skin suits being worn on humans. So it's an interesting interesting thing for me. I think I can go back to talking about the appropriation of the Western canon, because that's an important thing for me. Like, I spent a whole year drawing and redrawing and painting and repainting and unfolding this Caravaggio painting that I fell in love with, the inspiration of Saint Matthew. And I fell in love with it because I felt like there was some like wizardry inside of it, some sort of mysticism that I needed to capture, something in his composition that just like, I couldn't draw my eyes away once I saw it. But what I'm doing there is I'm talking about like not only obsession, but understanding history and then taking from it what I need in order to tell the story that I want to tell. And so we're going back to the history of St. Bartholomew, the history of Michelangelo and Sistine Chapel, and then going back into my own narrative, which is like, when I talked about the unfortunate aspect of code switching, because we all just want to be ourselves, and I don't want to have to I need to put my brown suit on when I'm around this group. You know, and I need to put my white suit back on when I'm around this group. And then my punk suit on when I go around these kids, and, you know, and I got to dress it up for the collectors. You know what I mean? You know, we've kind of like being dictated all these things and we just want to be ourselves. And so for me, like, painting and the sculpture that I made, the subsequent sculpture, is literally a depiction of me saying, like, look, I just want to be myself. Like, mm-hmm. this is me pulling my skin suit off and presenting it to you, and making this kind of this three-dimensional sculpture that's referencing like this kind of historical painting that's referencing this historical event. So it kind of unfolds in multiple ways, but for me, it is about like kind of attempting to remove the ego and to kind of like place it in front of myself in order to kind of just be there, you know, just to be here.
Yeah. The second piece I want to ask you about, which is actually, that was a, That was a great segue into this one. You have a piece it's the very first piece on your website under 2022. The quote with it is, "Death is our eternal companion. It is always to our left, at an arm's length. It has always been watching you. It always will until the day it taps you." The piece is made of rebar steel, steel, stained glass, lead, and magnets. Where are the magnets?
That was one of my funnest little tricks. If you look at the piece closely, you can see the tongue sticking off the side. It's sticking outside of the right frame on the website. There's a snake's tongue. Do you see that? Or are you guys in front of you? I don't know if it is or not.
In front of me, no.
Okay. Well, essentially, there's a Quetzalcoatl, a feathered serpent on the right side. There's a figure in the middle, and then there's a water movement, water or a waterfall on the left side. And the magnets are up inside of that tongue. That was essentially a kind of like a little fabrication trick. Because we've got a square framed painting that's got to go into a crate and be shipped from here to Miami. And I really loved the way that we were able to break that frame by having the snake's tongue go outside of it.
Yeah.
What I did was I embedded some like heavy duty magnets that would stick to the rebar, and I copper foiled those magnets and then soldered over the copper foil. And that tongue is now a removable object that doesn't get broken by an art handler or by someone else who's moving that work around, because it's in a fragile environment, let's say. You know what I mean? It can, it could break if it was just kind of stuck on there eternally. Yeah. Whereas if you can take it off and set it somewhere whenever you're moving it, it makes it a lot easier. So that's where the magnets come in.
I love that.
Fun problem solving thing.
Right. And around the skeleton's face, there seems to be a channel between your lead lines. Is that rebar in between?
That is.
Okay.
That is. There is, I talked about the rebar drawing aspect of these works, and I wish I could show you and maybe I can send it to you or something like that. That way you can see it. But essentially there's a rebar drawing underneath here. That skeletal character is completely surrounded by rebar. There is a plant growing out of his mouth into like roots, essentially depicting an underground world or the underworld. And then a plant growing up out of that. That is also surrounded by a piece of rebar. So you've got a rectangle that is all rebar, and then an internal structure that is also rebar that kind of acts as a reinforcing element. If that were just like stained glass, Tiffany stained glass, it would be really flexible. Mm-hmm. So having that rebar inside of there also adds a structural element that makes it stronger. That's been something to figure out too, because I had to find a certain type of copper foil that would stick well onto rebar, and then figure out how to, cut the glass to get it close enough to the rebar that, it would stay structurally sound. It's just different because it's not like the lead cane scenario where you've got the like channel that the glass mm-hmm. slides into, right? You've got a round thing, the rebar, and then you've got this like piece of glass here. And right. So that's where the Tiffany style of working came in so much better for me, because I was able to copper foil this when you put it together, the solder is now creating that channel.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The next one is Self-Portrait in Blue. It's steel, stained glass, lead, candles, and chain. It's a skeleton mm-hmm. hanging horizontally from chains, attached to rebar, attached to hooks. And then on the back of the hooks are candles burning. Mm-hmm. Is the skeleton, since it's a self-portrait, is the skeleton your size? Is it size to
scale.
You? To scale. It
yeah.
is. Okay.
To scale, yeah. Yeah.
And then
so
what's...
It's 6'2". It's a little bit... longer than 6'2" because he's kind of like his legs are tilted forward. Okay. They're not exact. It's not just like I'm laying straight.
Yeah. And what do the candles represent?
Well, you know, when we talk about that piece, I think there's like a little bit of a kind of whole story. I wish there were a simple answer for the candles. You know, I think not only culturally, but in my own personal way, I've had a fascination with death, and still do. And, you know, culturally, I would say on at least on my mother's side, there's, you know, the Day of the Dead within Mexican culture that is just like it has a reverence for the dead that exists in a different way than we do in the United States or than my American heritage does. Mm-hmm. And really experiencing that is an, you know, it's a really kind of interesting thing. And to kind of recontextualize death is difficult to do when we're in a society that tells you that that's the end. And so, you know, for me, it's about kind of even the work that we just talked about with death being on your left. You know, my own beliefs align themselves with death being kind of just a part of the process. You know, death and rebirth and regeneration into something new. You know, not really knowing where that goes or what that is, but always being a part of that, always being aware of that, you know, not necessarily looking at it as something I'm afraid of, but just recognizing that it's going to happen. You know, there's definitely a way that I used to live my life where I was much closer to that environment. And whether or not that was exciting, it was also, I don't know if exhilarating is the right word, and I can't really kind of describe what that physical draw is. You know, it'd be interesting to do a little bit more kind of research on where that is, but we can get back to, and with this work in particular, like the reverence for it, you know, and the kind of this work almost being an homage to it. You know, I think you could look back to, I don't know how old the work is that I have it in my, on my website, but I would be able to tell you, in every one of the work from, you know, the recent realism to my early abstraction that each one of those is a self-portrait in one way or another. And mm-hmm. by that, I mean, like, it may not look like me physically, but there are objects, elements, stories, patterns, materials inside of there that are a part of my existence and a part of my life. Mm-hmm. This work in particular is just kind of like as a follow-up to the previous set of works that talked about alter egos, this one is kind of like recognizing and confronting and embracing death. And so when I thought about the presentation for this work, I knew I knew that it was going to be a kind of horizontal positioning. I wanted the portrait to be laying down. I also wanted it to be between 6 and 8 inches from the wall. I find that that's the kind of like best distance for the projection aspect that I also try to absorb within, you know, wherever it is being placed and how the lighting looks. So we had those two things there. And then, you know, I went through a number of different scenarios for the presentation of the work. And I think that's where the kind of sculptural and bricolore mind kind of come into play. Mm-hmm. And with this one, I was just like really brought back to when it came to visualizing, I was thinking about crypts, you know, and this like kind of like torched uh, God, what are those called? My partner is fascinated. Like the candelabra, let's say. Okay. You know, so if you think about like a dark hallway that you're walking through, and you've got this like kind of object that is a candle that's kind of like leading you through this space. And that's what those kind of became, essentially, is like I was thinking about ways of presenting these things. And then I was thinking about, you know, light is one of the most important mediums of this work. So when I think about, every time you've mentioned what the medium list has been, light should always be a part of that, right? Like it's kind of a given for me, but it almost feels a little too much to write it down as a medium, but light, as I talked about, as the projector, as the kind of enhancer for this like living glass material, is a really important aspect of the work. And so having the candles behind these like kind of little stained glass, kind of like a vitrine / candelabras that I constructed, kind of became like little lights that led the way, I would say. And they just felt connected literally, right? Because they're like chained down to the skeleton that they're kind of escorting into the next life.
Yeah. So now if somebody buys that piece, is it up to them to?
Yeah, it becomes... it becomes, kind of completely up to them. I don't know if they light their candles or not. I'd like to reach out to them soon and find out, but, it's completely up to them. Actually, when we, presented that work, it was presented for, Freeze Art Fair here in Los Angeles in January. And, there are just so many outrageous codes with presenting an art fair in a building like they present that you, no matter how hard you try, you can't get a fire. I forget who the gentleman is that goes around and approves the booths, but he wouldn't go for the candles being lit. You can't have like a lit candle in a space like that. And so we had to present the work without the candles being lit, and my gallerist just had documentation nearby where he could show them photos of the objects being lit. So
that's cool.
Yeah, I think so. It wasn't my favorite thing. At one point I thought, well, we could throw in some of those LED candles, but it just doesn't work that way. You know what I mean? It doesn't have the same weight.
On your website also, I was looking at your CV or your curriculum vitae, and it's truly a masterpiece. Tons of exhibitions and residencies and awards and shows you've curated. You've also listed some press here, and just to name drop for you with a few.
Okay.
Take Your Child to Work Day is every day for this collector. It was a feature in the New York Times. Angelinos in America, a feature by Heidi Slimane, I think is how you say her name, Garage Magazine. This next one, I am not even going to butcher, but it's something with Prada, Marfa. It was a review, and it was in Vogue Mexico. Pulling Back the Curtain, interview Foundations Magazine, Max King Cap, IBIG Gallery, Timo Fehler. Did I say it right that time? Okay. Review, yes. Artillery Magazine. Deacon Penner, Nomadic Tendencies, Cultured Magazine. And Stephanie Eckhart, The Best Alternative Art Galleries in Los Angeles in W Magazine. That's not all of them. That was just like, you know, some.
A little glimpse here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been a funny thing, you know, trying to... as you started to read those things off, we are in a world where some of these accolades, let's say, in their presence and in their time, they feel so it feels good. It's reaffirming, right? And it's validating, and it's super helpful. It makes me feel seen, and I'm very appreciative of those experiences. I am glad to have the interaction and the conversations with the writers that I get to. I find that to be very important. Studio visits are a super important part of my practice. It goes through, I guess I would say it fluctuates as the studio starts to fill up. I start to try and invite people over that I love talking to and that I love kind of like bouncing ideas off, because it really helps me unfold the work itself to where I start to see different things as well. Because, you know, when you're working with it every day, you're not really seeing, or rather you have a very particular vision, and, you know, you bring someone who's a strange thinker, strange in a, like a very fascinating way, thinker in, and they're just like, oh, hey, what about this? And you're like, oh my God, yeah. What about that? I didn't even, where did that come from? It's been right there the whole time and I didn't even see it, you know? And that's a really important thing.
There's a few programs you've co-founded as well that I'd love for you to tell us more about. The first is BBQLA. BBQLA is a migrating installation conceived by Timo Fehler, Thomas Linder, and Adam Barris in 2015. In 2016, Patrick Kelly Cooper was added to the project as gallery director. BBQLA hosts creative programs in various locations based on a collective agreement and curated by either BBQLA team or through collaborative efforts. BBQLA's central location is in Los Angeles. Now, under the umbrella of BBQLA, there's another program called Meat Grinder. That's a youth-oriented art club community building contextual conversation in Los Angeles, California, currently in residency at The Shed in Mount Washington. Tell me more about Meat Grinder. What does it mean to you? What's the sort of premise of the program?
Yeah, let me dive in there. This is 2015 when BBQLA started as an artist-run space. And I just want to give a plug for Artist Run Spaces and for, again, this is kind of like an evolved essence of what I was a part of in Tulsa 20 years ago, which is like just doing things and creating a community. The three of us, Tom and Adam and I, met in Kansas City years ago, and then they eventually moved to Los Angeles, and we were sitting down at a barbecue at their house on a Sunday afternoon, and they said, trying to get into the artist community and begin exhibiting work. And, you know, how do we do that? And in my experience and what I had seen in the world around me and experienced, like, I guess, over the past 20 years was that, well, you do it yourself in some ways. And so we just started doing studio visits together. And we turn these like backyard barbecues into, kind of continued with the backyard barbecue thing and turned a little garage space into a gallery. And then eventually it became a kind of a literal gallery, and we brought in a director, and it was just like this, a really great experience that became a place for community, for a lot of like transient, Angelinos, people that had moved here. When you go to art school anywhere in the Midwest or in the United States in general, and you're serious about wanting to work in the arts afterwards, oftentimes you come to LA or New York. And so you've got all these kids landing here every year and not really knowing how to get involved. And this is a space for people to meet and to talk about future projects and to get food. It was called BBQLA because barbecue was an important part of the aspect. We all grew up in the Midwest and grew up eating barbecue, and it was just kind of like some way of doing things differently. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it took away the rigid structure of a gallery, and gave it a little bit more of a kind of communal eating space. After a year or two, it was kind of running itself and doing really well, having Patrick in charge of keeping everyone organized and motivated, and the curators coming through and the artists doing all of that. I had done a volunteer project working with some teens in Boyle Heights for a charter school. A guy I met through a running club had this charter school and was looking for a way for these kids who were kind of high school dropouts or had gotten kicked out of school to get their GED and to have he needed someone to give like a 2-hour arts course every Friday. And so I went in there and started doing that, started inviting outside artists. These are like East LA kids who, you know, were not familiar with art practices or galleries or museums. I was not a part of their daily lives. And so I was able to kind of like, you know, we took them to museums and the galleries and invited artists to come in. And it was really amazing to experience like the art world through their eyes, through these kids that were literally fighting just to get through their neighborhood.
Right.
You know.
Do you have any specific stories that you can share with us, with any of the kids that have been in Meat Grinder? Have you had the experience of witnessing a huge personal growth or any kind of like a developmental leap from being in the program?
Oh, for sure. For sure. You know, Meat Grinder was it started because Maximus Oppenheimer, a 14-year-old kid, showed up at a BBQLA show. And I saw him walking around. And, you know, it was mainly young adults there. And so I saw this young kid walking around and I just thought, well, that's interesting. And then a mutual friend of ours brings him up to me and said, hey, I want you to meet Max. This is Maximus. And I started talking with this kid and was just immediately fascinated with his just our conversation was just great. He was talking about the art and how he was inspired by it and who had done this and that, and kind of like knew all of these, not necessarily obscure references, but definitely things about the Los Angeles art world that your average 14-year-old doesn't know. And so immediately I talked to him at that project that I was talking to you before about had kind of ended with the school in East LA. And so I told him, hey, I want to start doing this thing again and working with the high school students. And kind of getting them integrated with and or experiencing the contemporary art world that is Los Angeles. And so we started having these kind of like club meetings. And Daniel Gibson was the first artist studio that we went to. We definitely saw shows at different galleries and had walkthroughs with curators and museums and things like that. So this was 5 or 6 years ago. Most of these kids were 15, 16 when I met them. They're now 21, 22. And I am fascinated by each and every one of their lives. There was a core group of 6 kids and they would invite, you know, we would have 20 to 30 kids at the different events that they would throw. Wade is probably the oldest of them. And they just finished a 4-year program at Cooper Union, which is a very amazing and prestigious art school to go to. They finished in June and an amazing artist. I'm actually convincing my gallery to put them in a group show soon, but I better not say that out loud, although I already did. but I love their work and they're amazing. Wade is great. Olinga is now starting his 3rd year in school in the Chicago Institute of Art Institute of Chicago, School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I forget what it's called now, but amazing painter. Ella is off in Europe this summer, but starting her 3rd year in the new media design at UCLA in Los Angeles. Sophie took some time off of school and is about to jump back into a creative endeavor here in Los Angeles. Max, who I started with, what's beautiful about all of this is that even the kids that are struggling are having a beautiful life experience, and it's really, I'm sorry, this is strange. A big part of why I do this is because I came from a space where I didn't have that. And I really wanted it. I can't say that I wanted it because I can't say that I knew what I even wanted. What I do know is that I can see myself in these kids, you know?
Yeah.
And I can see myself in that light, in that period of time in these kids. And I definitely know that I needed something a little bit different, some sort of other encouragement. And so, you know, when I see them struggling now, because like a teenager does and like a young adult does now, because they're 20 and 21 years old at this point. And, you know, they're going through things. And I try to be there as much as I can. And then I also, you know, kind of pull away when I have to, because I recognize that, like, you know, I'm definitely not a parent. I never wanted to be a parent. What I wanted to be was just like an older example of someone that's like kind of found a way to live this life. You know, not the only way, definitely, but just a way. You know, there was no, let's say, political structure to Meat Grinder. There was no like required permission slips or things like that. We didn't want to be affiliated with anything official within schools, because we wanted it to be about extracurricular and about giving of yourself and of your time, and just about being something that didn't feel like it related to the structure, the institution, the man, quote unquote, right? Because I didn't want that with these kids. I just wanted to, you know, I'm fascinated with youth culture and with teenagers and how they are changing the world. And, you know, it's important for me to be a part of that conversation, you know, to not only see how the world is changing, but to recognize that, like, you know, if I can be of assistance in any way, then, you know, I want to be. And a lot of people that were a part of that, including my partner, who, you know, her and I got really close through that structure. But we're a part of that. You know, I got to see that they also cared about the future in that way, you know? And, so yeah, I would like to, you know, they're all doing great. They're all doing great. And they're all over the place as well. You know, and here I am with a 10 and 11 month old thinking about the same thing. Like, you know, what is that future going to be like? Because when I see these kids go through shit, and I want to just pick them up and hold them and tell them it's going to be okay. And I think about my own like 10 month old that eventually is going to go through that thing. And, you know, it's like, I don't know. You know, I talked about my friend earlier who didn't make it, and he's not the only one, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, we don't want that for anyone, of course, but it's really hard when you see someone close to you that's ultra talented and a unique individual and that just kind of gets lost because maybe it's because, you know, they didn't have enough positive reinforcement and environment around them. So
yeah, that's incredible work. For our listeners, is there any way that they can help?
I would say the best help that you can give is, you know, embracing the world around you. You know, in that particular scenario, I can remember having a conscious thought of like, I really want to work with these kids again, because that project had ended. That school kind of folded, actually, the previous one. And then this kid, you know, came into my life. And I believe in the kind of like in the power of like recognizing that when you want to be of assistance to the world, that the world will present itself to ask for that assistance. And that's when you step in, you know? And so I think it's very, it's really easy. You can, you know, if it's about teens, you can either do a Google search, or talk to some, just talk to a teenager, you know, find out about what kind of programs are out there and whether or not you can be of assistance there. But I think, you know, the most important thing that I learned with BBQLA and with Meat Grinder was really just about like, when you do things yourself, you're like kind of like building this community that you're a part of. And so, you know, my encouragement as far as like getting involved is like literally just doing it. There were a lot of kids whenever we did a touring show across the United States with BBQLA, my partner who was a partner in that project, and we would kind of do these little talks in every city that we went to. And, you know, the biggest thing that I could tell them was like, hey, you know, we started in the backyard in a shed that was supposed to be a garage. And that's like the kind of key element to every great experience that I've had was just like, if you want to try and do something, then do it.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah. Find some other people in your community that are also like active and doing things. And, you know, Tulsa built that for me. And here I am 20 years later. I'm excited. I'm actually going back in a few weeks to meet with the museum in Oklahoma City, but also to meet with some of the people in Tulsa that seem to be like, you know, back then we didn't have, well, I didn't have the internet to be able to look into research and see what's going on. And I do now. And so I'm seeing these different kind of like organizations or Instagram personalities or whatever, like people that seem to be doing things. And I'm excited to see what that looks like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Final three questions. Who is your favorite artist? Do you have a favorite? You doesn't have to be like favorite, you know, but like who are you into?
Well,
right now?
Yeah. They could go down like the living or dead channel. I want to stay with like the living and the artists that are inspiring me right now. And definitely, you know, I talked about Rafa Esparza earlier and Beatriz Cortez. I didn't mention, but they are doing things that are not only super inspiring to me, but asking really good questions. Rafa and Daniel Gibson are people that I go to often when it comes to like asking questions about what it is that I'm even doing, and thinking about artists that are doing some really beautiful and inspiring things. And I love Hannah Levy's sculptural work right now. I'm kind of obsessed with those things and seeing really, you know, kind of like new conversations, like of classic, let's say Louis Bourgeois or something like that. Like these kind of classic sculptors that were really groundbreaking as well. And so I like the kind of evolved conversations that she's having there.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And what other stained glass artists would you like to shout out or acknowledge, somebody who's doing some work that you're really impressed with?
An artist named B.F. Fremderman also is doing some really weird things that I've been seeing for a while. Finn Simonetti, who is doing some like a really amazing stained glass works sculpturally, also works with cutting stone and is just a really interesting sculptor. Bea Fremderman also is making some really kind of strange anamorphic objects that are kind of stained glass, but including all kinds of detritus. Really, really beautiful works. I would say those two as far as like kind of working on the sculptural side of stained glass in that way. I've gotten, like I said, I've gotten the chance to, and I saw that you're interviewing, goodness, I haven't even met her yet, but I'm having her by the studio soon. Jax Partlow.
Oh yeah.
Is her Instagram?
Yeah.
Really interesting. I love that like you know, the kind of guerrilla aspect of their work. I'm super excited to see how that continues to evolve and to work with her. I learned a lot from Molly's Magic Glass. She worked with me on a number of these recent projects, and it's been really good to work with someone who has a lot of experience. And
she's really sweet. I met her.
Yeah.
I met her at Pasadena Stained Glass Supply. Yeah. I went in to get some rebar, not your rebar, but the other kind of rebar. Mm-hmm. And, and I was chatting with her, and she said that she'd worked with you and that she saw that you were coming on the podcast, and she was really excited.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Molly. She's, just a really cool soul. And, I love the work that she's doing. We've actually both been talking about, and I did also want to mention, when I went back to Amsterdam at one point, I found this thing, which it was called the Stichting Bergplatz. And it's what they are these like old commune squats that have turned into workspaces. And so it's like a communal workspace. And they also had these like different workshops. I paid 20 euros for 3 months membership. You go from 8 to 6, Monday to Friday. The hours weren't great. But you have full access to a studio and everything that entails. A metal shop, jewelry smithing, ceramics, stained glass. Of course, they want to check and make sure you know what you're doing. And then, you have free access to their studios. But they had also like some pretty cheap courses for, painting stained glass and, cutting stained, just everything about sculpting. So I didn't take any of the classes, but I definitely also found it to be a good environment whenever it was like, if you're in a room with five other people working, and you're kind of like feeding off of each other's energy. That's an interesting thing. That's what I got whenever I was working with, I had Molly and Alma Sophia and Ella. There were multiple artists in here that weren't necessarily, other than Molly, trained in stained glass, but we all kind of like found ways of working together. And I really appreciate those environments. I learned from working for an artist named Mary Weatherford for 7-8 years. What it was like to be an artist assistant, but also to be appreciated as an artist. It's hard. It's hard working for other people, obviously. And we're all doing it in one way or another, but especially in the art world, when you're seeing like how the machine actually works. And, we're all wanting to exhibit our work in one way or another. And and finding ways of doing that can be difficult.
Well, Timo, you are a wonder. You are not only incredibly talented as an artist, but you're making the world in the future a better place with your focus on this next generation, as an art mentor, and as a father. I can't wait to see what happens next. Keep doing exactly what you're doing, because it's definitely your calling. And I'm just really excited for all of it. Oh, I forgot the last question. Wait, hold on. One more. What are your 5 to 10 year goals?
Oh, wow. That's funny. That's not funny. The first thing that comes to mind is I'm going to have a 5 to 10 year old, in five to 10 years. We are trying to buy a place in Amsterdam. But also a big part of my community is here in Los Angeles. And so I think getting a little bit more settled, mm-hmm, somewhere, or, we've been in a very transient experience for the past 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
My partner and I, and now that there is a little one involved, like finding a way to settle, I guess, when I talk about 5 to 10 years of living, I would say that would be a good goal.
Yeah.
And as far as like the actual occupational side of it, continuing to be able to do what I love to do is kind of the everyday goal.
Yeah.
And that fluctuates. And I guess I I want to, I definitely want to encourage people. I'm 43 years old right now. And it's only been a year and a half that I've been able to work for myself. I spent a lot of time working for other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some people it comes right away, but it definitely took a long time, for me myself. So, you know, in 5 to 10 years, I want to be making work and living comfortably, you know.
Yeah.
And having all of the exciting things that come with, doing those things.
I love it. I love all of it. Well, thank you again for joining me. I know that you are super busy and you've got a lot of stuff going on and you just, you know, you carved this time out for me. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I got to say, I was honestly kind of intimidated whenever I first, heard from you. Cause I was like, oh, well, man, like, again, that imposter syndrome that I talked about earlier, like, fuck, I'm not a glass artist. Like, how do I have this conversation? And, you know, it's like we wrap our heads around our own insecurities and then push through them. Or at least that's something I've been able to do with a lot of work with my therapist and, you know, supporters around. So,
yeah, it's so funny. Perception is such an, you know, a finicky little thing, because I was really intimidated to talk to you because you do have such a formal art education and you do come from the gallery world. Yeah. We both wow. felt like a little bit of that imposter syndrome today for sure.
Yeah. Wow. Great. Great. Yeah. No, I'm so glad to be here. It's definitely been an honor and, a good kind of, introspective as well as, a generative conversation with you. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. Your work is amazing and you are very deserving to be on the Stained Glass podcast.
Thank you.
Well, have a wonderful and productive day in the studio today and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. To see more of Teemo's work, his Instagram is at team-o, that's T-E-A-M-O-H, and mine is at Runa Glassworks. For the Cracked Patreon page members, Teemo is offering a downloadable PDF of one of the patterns he used for a glass piece that's in his most recent show. Get into it at patreon.com/RunaGlassworks. For next week's episode of Cracked, we're heading back to England again to chat with Nick Sanders of Heb's the Bar Button. Till then, happy holidays to you. I hope you're spending quality time with friends and/or family. Stay cozy, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday. Bye.